Thank you, everyone, and welcome. Your Excellency, staff, students, and guests of the University, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here to the University of Adelaide today. My name is Jessica Gallagher, and I'm the Deputy Vice-Chancellor External Engagement here at the University of Adelaide. Thank you for joining us to hear from His Excellency, Mr. Vasyl Miroshenko, Ambassador of Ukraine. I would like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the lands where we meet today and pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are present today. Each year, the University is privileged to welcome members of the Diplomatic Corps to our campus to discuss areas of shared interests and consider how we might collectively tackle global challenges. These visits also provide an opportunity to explore critical issues shaping the world in which we live. And in 2022, few are more critical than what is happening in the Ukraine. Before I invite His Excellency to the stage, I'd like to share a few facts. His Excellency was appointed as Ukraine's ambassador to Australia on the 1st of April this year, and I understand that he's already been extremely active travelling the country and visiting with many of the capital cities and visiting with the Ukrainian community here in Australia. 1 month prior, on the 7th of March, he was appointed as an advisor to the Minister of Defence. In May 2021, he was appointed to the Supervisory Board of the Ukrainian Institute, a cultural diplomacy arm within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine. Prior to joining the Foreign Service, he was an active business and civil society leader in Ukraine. I'd now like to invite His Excellency, Mr. Vasyl Miroshenko, apologies, Your Excellency, to the stage to deliver his address, Global Impact of Russia's Invasion to the Ukraine.
Thank you very much. I'm extremely delighted to be here today with you. My first and my last name is a little bit complicated, but if I were Australian, I'd probably be called William Miller. So if you forget my name, think William Miller. So Vasyl is William Miller. It's what it means. My Miroshenko actually means a Miller. And so to make it simple, I'm extremely happy to be here at the university. I'm very pleased that I could be hosted at such a late notice and see these people coming here today. It means a lot to me. I've been here for 6 weeks in Australia, but I've been able to already visit a number of cities where I did some lectures. And as a matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, I was in Perth and I was hosted by the University of Western Australia. And I'm here in Adelaide, hosted by the university here. And I hope and plan similar engagements with in Melbourne and other places. I think it's extremely important for any diplomat to come and talk to the academics, talk to the students, and to reach out to the wider audiences. Therefore, I decided to reach out to the university, and thanks for Frank Frusenko for doing that for me. He's the leader of the Ukrainian community here, and he was part of the university life in Adelaide as well in the past. So where should I start? There are so many things I want to share with you, right? And I'm sure you're all following the news from Ukraine. You know what's going on there. But I would like just to give you some of the kind of give you the recap and provide you the updates of where we are right now, what challenges we face, and what needs to be done, and how I see it may play out, and also other aspects. But also just give you a little bit about myself. It was a very good introduction, which you heard at the beginning. But I want to also mention that I'm a non-career diplomat, so I'm a political appointee. And political appointee is somebody who is brought from business or from civil society, could be a former politician as well, who gets an appointment by a president. It works here in Australia as well, it works in the US, it works everywhere. Usually this is somebody who's donating lots of money to a political party, or is a close friend of the president. So I'm neither. In my case, I'm a grassroots ambassador. I pitched myself to the president saying, look, I studied international relations in Ukraine. I studied international trade at the London School of Economics for my master's. I was in business for 20 years. I set up several NGOs throughout my career. I was active in civil society. And I've done many projects on public diplomacy for Ukraine. Hence, I was invited to join the board of the Ukrainian Institute, which is an equivalent of Goethe Institute or Alliance Française or British Council, where I sit on an advisory board. Actually, it's a supervisory board. I've also done many projects on export promotion and investment promotion for Ukraine. For instance, my company was commissioned to organize the first Ukraine house in Davos during the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum, which is, by the way, is happening in 2 weeks from now. There will be a group of people doing this Ukraine house in Davos again. And that was used as a pavilion to promote investment into Ukraine. So I was very much aligned into kind of foreign policy issues. And also, most importantly, in 2014, when Russians invaded Ukraine first time, grabbed Crimea, my company, which is a communications company, and now it's run by my business partner. So I left the business, I'm now the civil servant. So I always say that my company seconded me to the government in these challenging times, and I'm here. But anyways, in 2014, when the Russians attacked Ukraine, my company, as well as a number of other companies, communications companies in Ukraine, we set up Ukraine Crisis Media Center. And that's a media hub news agency. And the main goal of this organization was to counteract Russian disinformation, Russian propaganda, and to be able to amplify Ukraine's voice internationally. It was a multilingual news agency streaming press conferences online, providing content from Ukraine, having different officials, Ukrainian officials as well as foreign officials visiting Ukraine to communicate. That was funded by international donors primarily, so different foreign governments chipped in. Our major donor was the US government, which pretty much funded this whole operation. At the climax, we had 50 people working full-time on communications issues for Ukraine. There was also a big project of improving communications of different government departments in 2015 that we've been able to implement within this work. So the reason I mentioned that, and we also done lots of work with the armed forces, with the Ministry of Defense, with different intelligence agencies, just general on communications. You'll be surprised, sometimes it just we had to teach people how to use Twitter and why Twitter is important. It was in 2014, 2015. So now often when I hear that, oh, Ukraine is so good at communicating, there was a great deal that was invested before, and it contributed to this resilience that we now see of Ukraine being able to fight and at the same time communicate good and effective channels of communication within among different departments. So, and sometimes we just had to do those trainings back then. Anyways, to cut a long story short, the idea of me being appointed as ambassador to Australia started in December. Usually it lasts 6 months, the whole procedure. It never comes like that. Some countries require the approval of the parliament, some countries don't, but it doesn't happen quick. It's not like the president decided to appoint somebody as ambassador and it's quick like that. So we have a DFAT here, so they know it takes time when somebody is approved and then appointed as an ambassador. So it all started in December, and I started preparing for that. I had to, get some documents in place and had to sit a test of Ukrainian language to make sure that I know Ukrainian language. And then I had to collect my credentials. There was a request for an agreement, which is an official document, which my government requests your government in Australia, saying, look, we would like to appoint this person as an ambassador. Do you mind? And then they would send a reply. So that reply came sometime in early February. And 3 days before the war, I brought like a big pile of documents for security clearance to the office of the president, 3 days before the war. And then the war starts. And we are in Kiev with my wife, with my two kids, my five-year-old son, my 18-year-old daughter. I have to tell you, frankly, I didn't think that would happen. Though we've seen Ukraine being invaded by Russia 8 years ago, we've seen this war already. However, we just could not grasp that Russians would actually invade Ukraine at a full-fledged war from three different fronts. So a lot of discussions which I've attended, I provided comments to international media about the strategic ambiguity of Russia building up the troops on the border. The idea was, okay, that they want to use it as a leverage over Ukraine, put more pressure on Ukraine. We thought they would mount an attack in Donetsk and Luhansk, trying to capture more territory, kind of to solidify their presence there around Donetsk and Luhansk, so-called People's Republics. But then, you know, that day comes, Joe Biden says, you're going to be invading, right? And I have to tell you, nobody in my circles actually left the city. Very few people who I know left Kyiv before that. Nobody did. We just stayed. It was kind of like even this weird feeling. If you leave, you're like a coward. Why are you leaving, right? So I have to tell you, nobody really left. Everybody stayed. So, and then my wife wakes me up at 5 o'clock in the morning saying, look, the war has started. So we heard explosions. We heard our air defense system working. Well, by the way, at that time, I didn't know there was air defense system because you just, and then, you know, 3 days later, you can already differentiate. Is this Russian missiles or this is air defense, right? Because it's just different sound. I never thought I would learn that. And we all became kind of displaced people by ourselves. I was not yet appointed, you know, I was in the middle of that procedure. Jumped in the car, packed everything we could in 2 hours, and tried to escape the city. It was like on the 24th of February. Kyiv is a city of 4 million people, and many people wanted to leave, so there was a huge traffic jam. And we just thought we would be able to do it, so we woke up 5 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, we're already on the road, and we just got stuck. 12 hours later, we are still in the city. We couldn't leave the city. It was just paralyzed totally. The direction towards west was totally blocked. So we sort of spent the whole day in the car, not being even legally be able to leave the city. We ended up staying on the outskirts of Kyiv at a house of our friends, who actually were smarter. They left for Lviv 2 weeks before that, but they had their housekeeper in the house, so the house was open, so we ended up going to their place. And that was only 20 kilometers from Hostomel. This is a military airport. This is where the Russian airborne troops were landed the same day, or you know, in those days. And the first battles took place there, in that place. So we spent like 2 nights in a basement. We couldn't find fuel. You know, fuel was gone, and so we needed fuel to fill up the tank to be able to like move west. And then I kind of, you know, looked around and found one place which still had fuel which we could get. And 2 days later, we got in the car and drove to my hometown, which is in Volochysk, Khmelnytskyi Oblast. It's a very little town in southwestern part of Ukraine, 350 kilometers southwest of Kyiv. So this is where I grew up. This is where my parents live. So we came there. My kids totally like traumatized, talking about war and everything. My parents kind of, they didn't hear the explosions, so they like, oh, come on, it's war is out there in Kyiv, but not in Volochysk, which is, you know, only 350 kilometers away. But, you know, you don't get the sense or the feeling until you hear that, right? So you get this bomb alert, so you have to rush into the basement, but nothing really exploded around you, and as long as it didn't, you don't get this sense of urgency or sense of fear or whatever it is. 2 days later, my wife says, look, take me out of the country. I want to leave. I cannot stay here. When I was in the U.S. For a summer business school once, 20 years ago, I was at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. It was a summer business school. There was a great guy from Moldova, my friend, Ion Nemarenko. He called me pretty much right away when the war started, and I just saw him, and he's now in commodity trading business, and he visits Ukraine quite often. He's based in Romania now. He gave me a call, said, look, my father lives just 2 hour drive from the border with Ukraine in the Carpathian Mountains in Romania. Send your family over here, and they can just stay with my father. So I did. I got them in the car, drove to the border. There is a city called Chernivtsi in the southwestern part of Ukraine. It's a beautiful city built during the times of Austria-Hungary. They have a very beautiful university there. If you ever go to Ukraine, make sure you go to Chernivtsi. The guy who was a professor there is called Professor Schumpeter. If you have students of economics here, you all know who is Schumpeter. So Schumpeter started his career in Chernivtsi. Later he moved, I think, to Vienna and then to the US. But if you read The Economist, there is a Schumpeter column. So Schumpeter was a professor at the University of Chernivtsi. It was times of the Austria-Hungary at that time. Anyways, I got there, I got to the checkpoint. And in Siret, and I saw a huge line of cars there. It was 1st of March, It was still snowing in the middle of nowhere, so it was just basically a field. And we get into this line of cars, right? And I told my wife, listen, you just stay here in the car. I'm going to walk to the checkpoint just to figure out what the distance to the checkpoint. So I walk, and it's about 4 kilometers long, right? All the cars lined up from all cities of Ukraine. And on the way back, I run into my friend, Natalia. I just saw her 2 weeks before that in the office of the Minister of Economy. And I'm like, hey, Natalia, so good to see you. And she was there with 2 little kids, with her older parents, 2 cars. And I go, like, Natalia, how long have you been in this line? And she told me, I've been here for 28 hours. 28 hours in the line. No food, no toilet, no nothing, you know? Just a field. And that's the moment when I realized that we need to get out of that line because, well, firstly, I couldn't cross the border. I had to stay, and my wife doesn't drive, so that car had no use, actually. So I basically took her to the checkpoint, and she crossed the border on foot. So my friend's family, I met them on the other side, and then they stayed there in the Carpathian Mountains for a week, and then moved to, I found a flat in Bucharest, they came there, and they stayed there. In mid-March, I got appointed as an ambassador. 2 weeks later, I picked up my credentials, and I followed the same route, because it was the fastest route out of the country, crossing the border on foot, along with all the displaced people, and made it to Bucharest, stayed there for 5 days, and 5 days later, I came to Australia at the end of March. So a week later, I presented my credentials to the Governor General, and I pretty much resumed my functions as an ambassador. So that's been kind of a long introduction into my personal story. Hope you didn't get bored. Now let's talk a little bit of geopolitics and what's going on, right? So I think it's very simple what's going on in Ukraine. And it's very straightforward. You have to understand, and we have students of history here, Russian Empire has been out there for a long time. It kind of evolved, right? And Russians have been always invading Ukraine. They always were subduing Ukraine, subjugating Ukraine. And it's been going on for 300 years. It's nothing new. Just whatever we've seen for a long period of time, right? And throughout our history, we had different periods when we had their own statehood. Going back to the Kievan Rus, which was a medieval state in the 11th century, which originated in Kiev in the, well, it was 9th century. It was one of the first nations in Europe which adopted Christianity in 988. And actually, at that time, at that period of time, many of the people from Kievan Rus married the kings and queens of France and other kind of royalty in Europe. Russia claims part of that history as well. So in their books, they claim that this is where Russia started. But it all started in Ukraine, in Kievan Rus. It wasn't called Ukraine at that time. It was called Kievan Rus, right? That was a part of Ukraine. Then, of course, in the 1500s and 1600s, it was a time when we had different big nations around us, such as Lithuania and Poland, which we were part of Lithuania and Poland state for a long time. Then we also had Ottoman Empire, which controlled, you know, big chunk of Ukraine from the south. Then, of course, we had Moscovia, as it was called at the time, the Russian Empire, but it was called Moscovia at the time. So there was a lot of like fighting going on at the time, at a period of Cossacks, and et cetera, et cetera. But all throughout this history, especially 200 years before the First World War, Russians have been always, you know, intentionally trying to destroy our language, our identity. Ukrainian language was banned, and many things were not promoted. It was all pretty much Russified, and the Russian culture was imposed. But this is how big empires do it, right? And we've seen it everywhere, right? It's even now here in Australia, I see a similar thing where a lot of Aboriginal people have lost their language. So many Ukrainians have lost their language, and they started speaking Russian. So when the Russian Empire collapsed following the First World War and the October Revolution, we had a brief period of our statehood in Kiev, which lasts for 3 years. We had 3 different governments there. It was very tumultuous, but that was the period when we had our statehood. This is when we adopted the flag, Ukrainian flag, which, and also our trident, which was a symbol. And by the way, this trident, which you see on the Ukrainian national emblem, goes back to Volodymyr, who was the ruler of the Kievan Rus 1,000 years ago. So that statehood was crushed. It was crushed by the Bolsheviks who came to Ukraine in 1921, destroyed everything, terrorized, killed, and subjugated Ukraine, proclaimed the Ukrainian Socialist Republic, and took over the country and started the massive collectivization of people. Ukrainian people like land. They like to cultivate land, and land is sacred in Ukraine. And when they were forced to go into these collective farms, they heavily resisted. So to incentivize Ukrainians to join collective farms, Stalin in 1932 and 1933 has organized an artificial famine, which was a genocide against Ukrainian people, which we now call Holodomor. In that famine, 6 million Ukrainians died. It was done artificially. It was actually their grain was taken away, and they just starved to death. But the purpose was very simple, to subdue any resistance from Ukraine and also to force all the Ukrainians into the collective farms. It also happened in Kazakhstan. It happened in other parts of in Russia at that time. But in Ukraine, it was really fierce. It was actually, the idea was to, you know, to destroy Ukrainians as an ethnic group, basically. In the 1930s, Ukrainians were imposed to severe terror where all intellectuals were killed, musicians, writers, poets, music players. Everybody was killed. All the intelligent people, intelligentsia as we call them, were killed by Stalin because that was a source of resistance. In 1939, Stalin signed a secret pact with Nazi Germany. They divided Poland. So Soviet Union came, they took over the western part of Ukraine, which at that time was part of Poland. Germans invaded from the other side. Well, you know, the Second World War, shouldn't be telling you the results of it. But I want to sort of go back and come to the collapse of the Soviet Union, because this is very important to understand what's going on now is actually how the Soviet Union collapsed. So Soviet Union collapsed peacefully. And this was like a major, you know, Francis Fukuyama end of history. And that, you know, it's gone. It's the end of the Cold War. Nobody could believe that the Cold War could end like that. Everybody was getting ready for a major, you know, nuclear war in the end of the world, right? It didn't happen. The Soviet Union could not sustain. The system didn't work. It was not viable. And they've started these democratic reforms called glasnost in the 80s. And that actually what brought the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Maybe if they've done the Chinese way, started the economic reforms first, and then politics later, maybe they would still maintain the Soviet Union, but they started the other way around, and I'm happy they did, because once they started these democratic reforms, it just couldn't hold together. 15 different nations in the Soviet Union, they wanted to have their own statehood, they wanted to have their own sovereignty, and it all collapsed. But in a way, nothing major happened. There were some skirmishes and some minor kind of conflicts in Transnistria, which is part of Moldova, and also in Armenia and Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh. So, yeah, some people got killed, but nothing major, right? It didn't really end. There was also something in Georgia. But nothing major has happened because many analysts believe that there is, okay, now the war is going to start. What was the problem in the 90s? The problem was Ukraine inherited the largest nuclear stockpile in the Soviet Union. I think it was the second one in the world at that time. So under lots of pressure and lots of London sort of negotiations with the United States, Ukraine decided to give up all its nuclear weapons in 1994. We said, okay, we don't need them. And of course, we understand that countries like Australia and US and Britain, they all were concerned. All these new fledgling states are there on the map, and they've got nuclear weapons. What if these nuclear weapons end up in somewhere in bad hands, right, and they can use it? So the concern was legitimate. But in exchange for that, we signed this document called Budapest Memorandum, which was a document which actually provided Ukraine with assurances, that's very important, I'm going to mention why I mentioned that assurances, they're not guarantees, to secure, to make sure that Ukrainian sovereignty integrity is intact. And Russia signed up, Britain signed up, US signed up, France signed up, and I think even China signed up because there were sort of different levels of those documents were signed up. So that document was supposed to actually secure that Ukraine is voluntarily the only country in the world that gave up their nukes will never be invaded, right? Because weapons of mass destruction serve as a deterrent. They serve as actually as a way to de-escalate, because everybody understands when you have weapons of mass destruction, you need to prevent the war from happening. So we gave it up. When Vladimir Putin became a president of Russia, he built his campaign on the chaos of the 90s of Russia. And he said, oh, that's the end of chaos. I'm going to bring order. And this is what Russians loved. You know, we have somebody who is not drinking, he is fit, he's KGB guy, we like this tough guys, you know, and he's going to bring the order. And he started bringing order, right? So that was the start when actually Vladimir Putin started the crackdown on any kind of democracy there, gradually. The oligarchs who owned media, they gave up their media assets. Some of them were sent to jail, some of them were killed, some of them had to flee. And gradually, as Putin was gaining more power, he started to be more articulate about actually his ideas. And for those of you who are studying international relations here or political science, there is a whole section about the role of ideas, right, in the kind of world affairs and global issues. So I think, you know, he got really fascinated with this idea of reviving the Soviet Union. And he was very clear. In year 2007, Vladimir Putin came to a Munich Security Conference. That's one of the major security conferences in the world, in Munich, where he made this address and said that, look, Soviet Union's collapse was the biggest disappointment. It was a tragedy for me, and I make it my plan that I want to do something about it, right? He was clear about it. In 2008, and Ukraine, as a country, we were aspiring to become, we're still aspiring to become member of the EU and member of NATO. In 2008, we were close to getting the membership action plan for NATO, which means a roadmap of how we can become full member states of NATO. We followed the path of the Eastern European countries, such as Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic and Slovakia. We saw when they joined NATO in 1999, then they, 5 years later, they joined the EU. We saw how it helped their economy, how they've been able to change. And that was a path that we Ukrainians saw for ourselves. Unfortunately, our aspiration to get a membership action plan during the Bucharest meeting of the NATO member states was blocked. It was blocked by Germany, it was blocked by France. These two countries were convinced by Russia not to do that. So we lost this opportunity to sort of sign up on this track. That year, Russia invaded Georgia. And what happened? Nothing happened. Some sanctions were imposed, not much. Obama is elected as the president. Hillary Clinton starts the reset of policy with Russia. Reset of the other relations. You remember that. It was like a big kind of thing. 2 years later, they say, oh, no, it didn't work out. It was a mistake. In 2014, Putin invades Ukraine, grabs Crimea, kills 14,000 Ukrainians, grabs part of Donetsk and Luhansk, you know, and we get into the war, you know, the war that lasts already for 8 years. And what happened? Some sanctions were imposed, not much. And this is what emboldened Putin, because if there is no reaction, he takes it as a weakness. If the West does not react to this, he says, okay, we can do more. And he did. So his calculation was very simple. He figured, well, this disastrous withdrawal of the US troops from Afghanistan, Macron, which was facing elections, new government in Germany, I can do it. Everybody needs my gas, everybody needs my oil. They will keep on buying it. All the Russian-speaking peoples of Ukraine will meet these Russian soldiers with flowers because they are Russians. That was a belief, and that was a wrong assumption, which Putin had 8 years ago, and again, he built his campaign on this wrong assumption that Russian-speaking people of Ukraine are Russian. And that's wrong, because Russian-speaking people of Ukraine are Ukrainians who lost their language, and I explained how they lost their language through 300 years. Now it's coming back. Putin bombed all the Russian-speaking cities of Ukraine, Chernihiv, Kharkiv, Mariupol, Melitopol, Kherson, Izum. These are Sumy. These are the most Russian-speaking cities of Ukraine. Totally shelled, destroyed. Whatever pro-Russian sentiment which existed in those cities is now gone. Putin lost Ukraine forever. No matter how this develops, he lost the people. He lost the hearts and minds of the people. We all have relatives in Russia. Many people have relatives in Russia. I have relatives in Russia. And everybody does. Because it was part of the Soviet Union. People traveled. There was mobility within the Soviet Union, right? That is all gone. I have no families. My friends, it was like, you know, a wife of my best friend, her mother lives in Moscow. And she cannot convince her mother that actually Russian people are killing Ukrainians, raping women, killing children. Her mother does not believe her. Can you imagine how brainwashed people are with this massive Kremlin media, empire that they've been able to build? They believe that the Bucha massacre was done by the special intelligence officers from Britain who came there and who dispersed all those corpses there and blamed Russia for that. All Russian people believe that, most of them actually. I can talk about Russian propaganda and disinformation for a long time. I'm just going to give you some of the examples of how it can work. If you're interested, I can answer some questions. But look, what we are facing now, a difficult time, right? Because we have to keep on fighting. Nobody predicted that we could last so long. The estimate was the following, that Kyiv would fall in 3 days. They would install a puppet government there, and Kyiv is done. Ukrainian ambassador in Germany went to see the Minister of Finance when the war started, and he said, give us money to buy some weapons. You know what he told him? Yeah, he told him, no weapons for you, your government is gonna fall, we're gonna work with a puppet government, just sit and wait. He got out of that meeting, he made it public in German media. So what we are seeing is something that we need to keep on fighting, because if Russia stops fighting, it's the end of the war. If Ukrainians stop fighting, it's the end of Ukraine. I'm very grateful to the Australian government for the military assistance. So far, we have received $225 million in lethal aid, which include bushmasters, some artillery, anti-tank missiles, and other equipment, which is being sent and provided. We also got $65 million in humanitarian assistance. We got a donation of coal. There are sanctions which were imposed. I'm lucky because I'm in Australia. I think my ambassadors who serve in other countries, they don't get this kind of welcome. My ambassador in Germany is actually having a hard time, though Germany is also changing, by the way. I mean, they've admitted that their policy in Russia was flawed. But also countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, India, and all the Southeast Asian countries, they haven't been that vocal about their position on what's going on. They don't really care about values, democracy, rule of law, human rights. I'd say, no, look, we have some interests that we need to pursue, so we just better shut up and just do business with Russia because, you know, we have large populations, we need to feed them, so we have our own kind of interests, which I kind of understand, because every nation has an interest, right? But at the end of the day, if Ukraine falls, what implications is that gonna bring? How will it embolden Iran in the Middle East? What will Iran do? Will they invade Israel? What will China do, right? How this precedent can be dangerous? Because if one country decides to change the border of another country by force, that's extremely dangerous because it can cause a domino effect and it may just all fall apart. Anyways, I think I've started to talk too long. I think there may be some questions. I'm happy to answer those questions. So please raise your hand, introduce yourself, and ask a question. I'll try to answer.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency, both for talking us through your personal experience, but giving that broader historical and geopolitical context. Unfortunately, we are on a very, very tight time schedule today, but I would like to offer one question. So if there is one question for the ambassador. Yes.
My name is Kostya Kuzmin. I'm a registered migration agent. I'm also a person of Ukrainian descent, and I'm also doing a PhD in the School of Law here, PhD in migration law. Thank you, Ambassador, for your passionate speech. I have two questions. They're basically one, but they have two parts. So because of everything that you have said, have you spoken to the Australian government whether the Australian government wants to consider recognizing the actions of Russia in Ukraine as genocide? Because today our topic is the global effect, and this will have a global effect. Extremely important, and because there have been media reports that those massacred, raped, and tortured in Bucha, and the way they were killed, there is an indication that the first ones to be massacred and murdered in the most violent way were in fact Ukrainian speakers. This is a genocide. Have you asked the Australian government to recognize it? And if yes, what have they responded to you? And the second question connected to the first one, the Russians are basically stealing everything that they can see because this is their style of doing war. They don't fight the military, as you have correctly said, they fight the civilians. In the south, they are already taking out the grain from Ukrainian ports. Does that indicate a possible shortage? It is already indicating some danger in many countries where Ukraine used to supply grain to. And if it is dangerous, have you potentially flagged this to the Australian government that Ukraine as a state might also need food supplies?
Yeah, good. Very good questions.
Thank you.
On the first one, on the genocide issue, some parliaments have already adopted resolutions, and I think it was in the Baltics, Latvia and Lithuania, I believe, and Canada has started the deliberations. You were studying a student of law. That takes time, and we'll have to engage with the Australian government here after the elections, when there will be new parliament in place, because a great deal of that will have to happen in the parliament. So you have to have a new parliament in place. So I'm sure we'll work on that. Of course, from a standpoint of international law, it's very important that we document everything and we can then use it in all the investigations and be able to actually prove that it's a genocide. But, it takes a little bit of time and how to do that. But what we know for sure is that Russians, they've actually published an article about a month ago in a Russian media outlet where they have offered a solution of how to solve the Ukraine problem. And the steps that they offered in that article, it was widely translated into English, it's available online, you can read it. The idea is reminiscent of the Stalin times. It was like, okay, we need to subdue any resistance. How do we do that? Through terror, right? So we launch labor camps, we put people in those labor camps, others can leave the country who are like they cannot work with. We're gonna just execute people who are the most vocal. And there was a whole plan. It's like a blueprint of what we're going to do, how we're going to take over Ukraine and just subdue any resistance. So, and it is clear indication that the plan that was offered is plan of a genocide, actually, because it was ethnically oriented towards the Ukrainians. So that's one part. On the second question, it's a very good question because I didn't talk about investments, trade, and all these issues. 70% of Ukraine's export goes from the Black Sea ports. We now cannot export anything. And Ukraine is one of the largest producers of grain, barley, sunflower oil, animal feed, vegetable oils. We are a big contributor to the food security in the world. There are certain countries which totally depend on the food they get from Ukraine, like Egypt, like many other countries in Africa and the Middle East. People will starve this year. The surge in prices for commodities for these products is already a major blow to the economies of those countries. Because they are poor, they don't have a cushion, which some of the richer countries have, and they are heavily affected by this surge in prices for commodities. So Ukraine is now totally economy are suffocating. We cannot export anything. Russian ships are in Black Sea, floating mines. And the way Russians behave is actually interesting. You mentioned that. When they occupied these towns in the northern part of Ukraine, they've been looting Ukraine. And you know the videos and the intercepted conversations that we've managed to publish are just mind-blowing. You just realize how poor Russians are. And many of those soldiers come from these remote places in Russia. Not many from St. Petersburg, Moscow have signed up for that, right? So they come and they're actually allowed to steal, to rape, to do whatever they want. And that's kind of a reward for what they get for that. So they've been looting refrigerators, washing machines, everything. And that, like Bucha, is a very well-off suburb of Kyiv. It's in the forest, extremely beautiful. Beautiful buildings, kind of in a Canadian style, townhouses built there, some expensive properties there. So when they got there, they were like, look how Ukrainians are living. So they just on purpose destroyed that property. They shelled buildings just because they just hated it. They just couldn't believe people can live better than them. So they just on purpose destroyed that, looted it. Chechens have been looting our agriculture equipment, stealing our harvesters, stealing our tractors. Because they have GPS, we could then track them down to Chechnya. Also, something they couldn't steal, they would destroy. So they destroyed on purpose agricultural machinery. They destroyed grain storage facilities. So that was done on purpose. I cannot explain that, but this is what we see. What's the motivation for that? It serves no military purpose, but that was just done just to destroy it. Yesterday, missiles again flew into the Odessa airport. And it's a brand new airport. I was there last year. And I was so happy. Odessa is one of the most popular destinations in Ukraine. And finally, they got a new airport there, you know, new runway, new kind of hole there. And I'm like, wow, finally Odessa got a new place. Just 1 year later, they just totally destroyed. 7 missiles flew into Odessa yesterday. Shopping mall burned down. Airport destroyed. I can understand the military purpose of an airport, but why destroy a mall that was also brand new? It's difficult to comprehend as many things which Russians have been doing in Ukraine, but I know for sure that, look, we need to repel that attack, we need to get them out, we need to defeat Putin. That's the only way out. There is just no something in between. And for that, we need to have strong military and strong economy. This is what we need. And my pitch here to Australian audiences that I meet, apart from asking your government, ask your politicians, it's not elections, please go ahead, talk to your politicians and your constituencies. What are you doing for Ukraine? What do you plan to do for Ukraine? Please do it, it's important. So they come to the parliament, they will talk and they will do something. I talk to business here because I believe Australian investors can invest in the mining industry, in the oil and gas industry, in infrastructure development, in ports, in rebuilding the schools and hospitals. I talked to the association of the wine producers here, and I said, look, we'll need your investors who can come. We have some areas in Ukraine where you can have some good vineyards. They can invest, and we can, of course, benefit from buying more wine from you here, and that would be very much welcome, given that you cannot sell much in China now. We like wine, and we would drink it.
So unfortunately, we are going to have to whisk His Excellency away. I know that we could have spent much of the afternoon here sitting and talking about with questions. Thank you very much for the generosity of your time and your Sure. insights and the importance of coming together as a global community to look at what is right and to prevent the needless loss of lives. But on that note, can I ask you all to join me, please, with thanking His Excellency for joining us this afternoon.